Today, I'm interviewing Ian Dallas, who is the creative director of Giant Sparrow, previously the developer of Unfinished Swan. And this month, I think it's coming out, is What Remains of Edith Finch, which
Yeah, it'll be
is.
out April 25th for PlayStation 4 and PC.
Okay, is that everywhere or is that US? Is that Europe as
I
well?
believe that's everywhere. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, it will be out there
Somewhere.
eventually, and I'm 90%, 99% sure that it's the same day in all the territories.
Okay, great. Excellent. Because it is on my list of indies to look out for 2017. So, so for those who aren't familiar with it at all, how would you describe What Remains of Edith Finch?
I would describe it as a collection of short stories about a cursed family in Washington State. And as a player, you take on the role of Edith Finch, who is coming back to this house that she grew up in, and she's exploring the house. Everyone at that point in history is dead, except Edith. She's the last family member alive. And in each of the bedrooms, she finds a story about how that family member died, and then plays out the kind of final moments as a playable game, experiencing the last moments of that family member. So she's sort of going through the entire family tree for a couple of generations of her family and finding out what happened to everyone.
Okay. So when I saw the trailer and it seemed quite spooky and at first glance I thought, oh, this is quite a big departure from Unfinished Swan, which had quite a sort of stark visual style. I mean, it was white for a large portion of it and had the really interesting ink splash mechanic. However, when I started playing the little section that you gave me to try out, the Molly's level, I think there are some similarities there. I thought that had that same sense of a fairy tale. There are sharks, that's comfy. And dreams form a central part of the story, and there's also a sense of a journey. Do you think that's a fair assessment? And what would you say are the themes that you've carried across from Unfinished Swan to.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that visually they look quite different. The last game was, more kind of fairy tale-esque and a more overtly surreal. And one, visually looks relatively normal for the first part of it. And then the family member stories, get a little bit more stylized, but still, within the realm of, lived experience and less, completely fantastical. I think under like at a base level, they're both games that are about the unknown, and they're about, what it feels like to be in a place that you don't understand. They're also both games about architecture in a way that like I didn't expect that they would be. And in both cases, like I didn't set out to make games about architecture, but because they're played from a first person perspective, that was just something that kind of naturally lent itself to sort of the affordances, like the way that players are already encountering that experience, a first person perspective, like is, architecture plays a very big role. And so you're exploring this house, and then inside of like Molly's story, for example, you're really exploring these very different environments, as
Yeah,
and
so
then like a very overt literary reference as well in both cases. I mean, not just to like specific literary references, but more to like the feeling of reading books and stories. An Unfinished Swan or children's books, and here it's more the feeling of short stories. But each of the family members, we're trying to remind players that they're playing a story, like a version of events that isn't necessarily what actually happened, but is just, one perspective.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you actually that both games have very sort of fixed chapter structure, and I wondered why you did that, and if it was
Yeah, I
to
mean, that's.
make it feel like a book, like a story that you're traveling through.
Yeah, I definitely you know, we want to remind players that there's this structure of a story, because you are not even just going into one story. Like, sometimes you're going several stories deep, you know, where you're in a story and then someone else starts telling you a story. And, you know, that's, I think, part of the fun of these, you know, kind of tales. Like, we drew a lot of inspiration from weird fiction, which is, you know, this genre from the 30s that kind of predates horror, that, you know, is more about the kind of ominous and unknown world that, you know, surrounds us. And, you know, the unreliable narrator is a common part of that, but also just the way in which, you know, these stories get nested, where it's, you know, someone who is telling you something that they heard from someone else, where there's this kind of these layers of potential beauty. And, you know, I think getting back to that kind of literary reference thing, you know, for me, one of the things that I wanted to do on The Unfinished Swan was to make the story feel like you were actually reading a book in some sense. So, you know, just in terms of the experience of being a reader, you know, for me, one of the things that I really love about books is that you can tell how far you are in the story. Like, you're never in doubt, because you can feel the, like, you know, the number of pages that are left.
Yeah.
And there's a very elegant way in which that sets up anticipation, in that you know you're coming to the end, that you don't really have in movies and for the most part in games. But I think is really helpful, especially, you know, we try in our games to strip out a lot of the more overt kind of gamey conventions, things like floating arrows telling you where to go, or, you know, collectibles and things that otherwise, like, I mean, they serve a lot of really valuable functions, you know, telling players, like, giving them a sense of where to go and telling them, like, roughly how far they are, you know, like, if you saw, you know, like a chapter select screen and there were, you know, there's one chapter left, that's a really good way of telling players, you know, how far they are along. In this case, you know, we have this family tree that you'll see throughout the game. After each story, Edith fills it in, and then in the pause menu, it's also there. And it gives players a way of, like, not only understanding the family, which can get a little confusing, you know, who's related to who and who's the father, you know, because you'll see people also different times in their lives. But it also helps players to have a sense of, you know, how close they are to reaching the end of this. And, you know, it's a game about endings. It's all of these stories, you know, ending with a different family member's death. So we wanted players to have a sense of, you know, how that was progressing.
Right, yeah. Because one of the things I really loved was the way you used the text to draw the player along. Like, it'll be sitting along the top of a gate, for instance. And then in Molly's room, I think it is, the text appears wrapped around the back of a sort of easy chair, which meant that...
Good memory.
Sorry?
Good memory.
But it just meant that in that room, I sort of moved naturally towards that chair. So what other techniques do you use to kind of guide the player through without making them feel kind of railroaded, or, you know, that there's too clear a path that... you as the developer want them to go down?
Yeah, I mean, I would say our primary tool is just a huge number of playtesting sessions, where we bring in players and have them, you know, try out the, you know, the new environments that we've built, and then, you know, cross our fingers and hope, and you know, we make a ton of mistakes. But, you know, there's a lot of, at this point, you know, pretty good kind of best practices in game design for things that, you know, kind of naturally lead people along. And a lot of it is, you know, clearing away things that would otherwise attract a lot of attention. So, you know, even just like as basic as, you know, making the destination brighter, you know, or like a different color. One of the things in games, you know, is that people tend to want to move upwards. So a lot of our environments, you know, are kind of constructed going from a lower place to a higher place, and often in kind of a spiral pattern, that it's weird, just sort of like naturally, you know, things evolve that way. And then, you know, any movement can certainly help the player. So, you know, in Molly's story, for example, we have a scene where you're chasing a bird, which is like a very natural. I mean, it's part of the story. Like, it also, you know, helps in that respect. And then, you know, the text is something that we use as sometimes like a means of last resort. I mean, we do have a certain amount of text that we want to put into the world anyway, and it adds a lot of character. But that's like the hammer, you know, we bring down. Like, if you really just do not. Exactly. And it's really useful because sometimes, you know, there's just no other way to, you know, guarantee. And sometimes, I mean, you don't have to guarantee that everyone's going to have the same experience, but there are places where if people miss something and they keep walking past it, then, you know, they get very lost. Or like, we actually had a challenge about 6 months ago or so, once all of the stories and, you know, the kind of skeleton of the house was all in place, where a lot of players were missing a couple of the stories, where they would just kind of walk right past it. And the game is set up so that a lot of these stories are optional. Like, we're not forcing players to do everything, but the hope is that, you know, these bedrooms, you know, raise questions in your mind about who it is, and you know, players want to experience these stories. So, you know, in a few places, people would just kind of walk past and not see the stories. So, you know, a lot of work there. Like, one of the kind of funny things that we did in the last couple of months is we really started to, like, fine-tune that was we have these what we call use icons, these, you know, kind of white glowing dots and gold that that indicate, you know, things that can be interacted with. And we changed the scripting so that the distances at which those things become visible to the player will change based on what you've done in that room. So, you know, there were some stories where, for example, there'd be like, you know, say a journal on a table, and then there'd be a window that you could, you know, open and then leave the room. So, you know, players would come into the room and then they might see the window first and then be like, oh, great, I'll go out the window. But we set it up now so that, you know, if you interact with the journal, then the window is a lot easier to see. Like, you can see a little white icon farther away. So it's kind of naturally something that players discover, but it doesn't feel like they're being led by the nose or anything. So, you know, we're trying a happy balance where people feel like it just magically works. Which we also ran into a big problem, actually, like 6 months ago, where, again, when we got to this point where things were like mostly working, where we found that because we had done such a good job on the first half of the game, where we'd spent, you know, a lot of our time, players got into this kind of mental state where they just felt like everything was going to naturally work out for them. So they didn't work that hard trying to, like, because there are some games where, like, that's the game, is struggling to understand where you're meant to go. They just felt like, oh, this game, you know, I'm just like enjoying, you know, everything that's around me, and I'm not worrying about, you know, like, I'm not panicked about finding the exit. So then, like, because we'd done such a good job in the first half of the game, by the time they got to the second half, which is a lot rougher, they were completely lost because they also just didn't, like, they needed to pay any attention. And it was like, oh, whoa, you know, suddenly there's a quiz. So I had to take a lot of the lessons we'd learned earlier on and find ways to apply them later.
Because I was going to ask you, actually, how soon into a project do you give it to people to play, and how much impact do those responses have on development?
I mean, pretty early. We previously we were at Sony Santa Monica, so we had, you know, a building full of other game developers, so it was very easy to just pull people in. So yeah, I mean, within, you know, 2 months, I would say, you know, whenever we have something that is kind of playable, and we'll have, you know, people on the team play it initially just to see if it works at all. But then, you know, getting people in to do, you know, like short sort of, you know, 10-minute play tests or something. And what we also do is, like, probably like a year into development or so, we'll start doing these things we call focus tests, where we bring in like 5 people at a time and then have them play through the entire game. Because in a game like this, it's also like you get a very different experience when you play the whole thing and when you see these stories back to back than you do when you're just playing them in isolation.
Visually, it's still very beautiful, but it's very different from Unfinished Swan. What Remains of Edith Finch has a lot more detail. There's a sense of a family and lives lived. And Edith has these beautiful hands with her knitted fingerless gloves.
Oh, thank you for everything. Yeah. Quite difficult.
Yeah, I bet.
Gloves is not something that games are usually, built to handle.
It's a really nice detail. But what made you opt for the more realistic visual style in contrast to Unfinished Swan?
Yeah, well, I think, part of it was the desire to have different visual styles for the stories from the primary experience of wandering around the house, just to provide, some discontinuity, so the stories felt like, their own universes. But then, we wanted to make the house, in Edith's area, feel a little more familiar and almost mundane, so that the surreal, feelings of the stories, again, would contrast more with that. Okay. And I always liken it to the Arthur Dent character in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where you have a story that is about all kinds of crazy things going on, but without grounding it in something clear, it's easy for all of that to just feel like nonsense. And I think, or like Alice in Wonderland. Like, if you had an experience in Wonderland without Alice, all of that just sort of loses a lot of the, connection to your own life.
So the familiar with the fantastical kind of...
Yeah, exactly. And the house was our familiar in this game. And it was also something... So I was like, initially we set out with that goal in mind, but then also, it was a function of the people that we had on the team and who we ended up hiring. So one of the people that we hired, our lead artist, had been at Call of Duty, actually. So it was kind of an unusual jump from, designing and doing art on Call of Duty to working on our games. But, he came from a place of, much more realistic art styles.
Right.
And so, I think that was something that we found he was really excited about and, had a gift for. So we did more of that kind of semi-realistic environments with, slightly hyper-real lighting. And then the engine itself that we were using this time, the Unreal Engine, also just does a really great job of that kind of lighting, rich, detailed, subtle, lights. So, it's kind of a combination of factors that led to doing that. I mean, I had no idea the game would look the way that it does now. I was kind of expecting to be a little bit more, fantastical and similar to our previous games. But, the combination of, the game's tone and the people that we had and then the tools that we were working with, we found that the slightly more realistic lighting and rendering style was a good fit for this game.
Okay, great. I mean, it does look beautiful. The house. The house is this sort of higgledy structure.
And it's ramshackle majesty.
Yes, exactly. It's almost like a family tree in house form.
Exactly.
How did that come about? Was it ever designed as a conventional house that an architect might have actually come up with? Because it's kind of it's the grounding element. It's from the outside. When you're inside, it has a very different feel to when you're looking at it outside, because it looks like this kind of whimsical tower in the middle of a wood. And then inside, it's books and dirty dishes. And
it's something that grew up very organically from the story itself. The core of this game story is that there's a family that has gone through a pretty intense, unusual, couple of generations. And the house was the concrete version of what that family's history would look like. So, you know, in the case of the first two floors of the house, like, they're fairly normal. And you'll during the game, you'll see photos and, you know, get to experience a little bit of the house at that time. And it looks basically like a regular house. But then, because in this family, there's this, you know, convention of whenever anyone dies, they just shut the bedroom door and then never go in that room again.
Okay.
As they have more children and, you know, as their subsequent generations, they start running out of room in the house. So they have to keep building onto it. And that's where you get like the third floor being, you know, a little bit more, you know, like a little bit less stable and a little more kind of like a barnacle on top of it. And then by the fourth and the fifth generations, you know, things are more and more structurally unsound in the way that the family itself is kind of, you know, grown into this kind of strange thing, this sort of twisted version of it itself. A little more Stanley Robinson. We also looked at like Spirited Away, the hotel in that movie that has all of these very organic bits that was also tying back into this idea in the game of, you know, civilization versus the natural world, where things that kind of bleed between those. And I think for me, the text in the world is another one of those where, you know, text is an incredibly civilized entity. You know, it's a human creation designed to facilitate, you know, the transmission of human ideas. But when you look at a page, there's a way in which it can become like a purely visual element that starts to feel like a natural thing, you know, the bark of a tree or something, like something where there's a ton of complexity that you can no longer read. So when the text is moving around, it becomes, you know, a more organic thing, in the same way that the house, when it grows to a certain size and has, you know, this kind of threshold of bizarreness to it, it, you know, it becomes more of an organic entity than like a more traditional civilized human one.
When I first saw it, just purely from trailer and stills, I thought it has elements of the Norman Bates house that may be just a sort of North American kind of house style. And of course, everyone now is like, oh, it's the house of a killer. But it may give people certain expectations in terms of tone. Did you consciously create a classic spooky looking house? Because from what I played, it wasn't the sort of spooky experience I thought it was going to be. I mean, it's pretty kind of out there and wild and took me by surprise in the best possible way. But so I don't know if there's stuff to come that will sort of meet those expectations or...
No, I mean, we try to avoid making it feel like a horror game. I think a lot of old houses that people return to in video games and movies and books that, you know, are full of cobwebs and, you know, monsters jumping out of closets. And there's like, there's definitely some fun in that. You know, I think it's like, there's this Vincent, I think it's Vincent Price movie, the house, the haunted, I can't remember the name of it. But it's like, you know, basically a bunch of people have to live in a house for, you know, a weekend. And then, spookiness, you know, ensues. And, you know, I think we were going for more of like the Shirley Jackson, The Haunting or House on Haunted Hill, whatever. I can't remember what the book is, but the movie that they made of it, you know, is The Haunting. And they're two very different visions of like, in that case, like 1950s movies about haunted houses that I think are interesting divide there, where, you know, a house can be inherently unsettling and ominous. And it's strange that houses have this history of, you know, being the main characters in horror movies and books, because, you know, on the surface of it, it doesn't seem like there's anything that threatening about it, but there's something about the way that they accumulate history and their size is and the way that they, you know, hide things, that, yeah, I don't know. Somehow they like, they become this ominous, threatening thing. So we're definitely trying to make the house feel ominous and overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think we're trying to avoid some of the tropes that players might have come to expect from a house that is, you know, that, that has a sense of kind of an ill wind that blows from it. And in our case, like, we also were really trying to make the space feel intimate. So we were more concerned about conveying a sense of what a space looks like after a number of generations have lived there, where you can see, you know, the hand of, you know, previous generations on a space and the way that gets kind of adjusted over time, than we were with, you know, trying to make players afraid, you know, when they turn this corner, with the hope that, you know, there's enough here that the house actually ends up feeling somewhat overwhelming on its own merits. Like, we don't have to play shrieking violins to get people to be a little antsy. Like, it's enough just to have a wall, you know, covered in photographs that feel like, you know, they depict this, you know, family history that you're never going to totally understand, that it's something, you know, that is kind of goes beyond the page.
Yeah. The empty stair lift as well.
yeah, and that's one of my favorite things in the game, where you've got this incredibly detailed newel post, where, you know, like the banister, you know, at the bottom of the stairs, carved out, and it's actually like carved into the shape of the house itself. This very loving, you know, thing from, you know, the 30s that's been done next to this, you know, much more modern stair lift from someone who, you know, it's like at the point in the game when Edith was living in the house previously, she was living with her, you know, 90-plus-year-old grandmother, or great-grandmother, rather. So, you know, the great-grandmother has this stair lift installed because she, you know, wants to live upstairs in the room she's always lived in, but she can no longer get up and down those stairs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think there's some room for very interesting contrasts
in the house. Yeah, I really liked that about it, because it just felt like, because it's one of the things that games quite often give their characters to live in, these kind of sterile boxes, with not a thing out of place, and there's just no life clutter, and it doesn't feel like anyone could have ever lived there. It looks like they've just been kind of transported there.
Or like they're about to sell the house. And they've
they just never go there. They hate that house so much they're not going to buy anything for it.
right, it's like their summer house. And I think one of the things that also really helped us in this game was that we had a very long development cycle. So, you know, over the course of the 4 years that we were making this game, you know, we were able to add a lot of junk to these rooms, where we would do a version of the room and then, you know, we would keep kind of making new versions and improvements, and in some cases, like, throw everything away that we had in terms of, like, the arrangement of the space, because it just wasn't working right. But that kind of layering of, you know, like, the history of the room itself, yeah, that we had made, you know, made the room actually, in a lot of cases, I think, feel like it had its own history, because there are these details that just, like, you wouldn't get in a first pass. They're only things that come in, you know, after you're kind of taking a little bit from a previous version and adding it to something else. And, you know, there's a sense of accumulation that you get from working over a space for a long time, just as a game developer, that mirrors, hopefully in some ways, the sense of accumulation that a room gets in real life.
And I suppose as you come to know your characters better as creators, there are just things that you might know about them that you didn't at the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Grow with them, and it's like, oh, they'd totally have these kind of slippers or whatever it might be. I think it's the small part that I've played was really successful at sort of stripping away those expectations of a spooky house with creaky floorboards to make me feel spooked out just for the sake of it.
Good.
Yeah, it was, it surprised me. It was really great. The Finch family has a lot of books. I mean, it's almost a sort of compulsive problem, I'd say. They haven't got enough bookcases for their books, but I did have. I'm a literature graduate and I write fiction, so I was perusing their bookshelves, and I was wondering how much care did you put into choosing the titles on their shelves? Do they have any significance, without spoiling?
Yeah, no, they do. I mean, there's no like mystery to unlock where suddenly
No.
it's like, oh, I get it. Because they're reading French, that means they were the killer. It's more about like, giving each book something that feels like, oh, they might have read that, or like, oh,
Right.
they're interested in woodworking. A lot of these things also are things that are kind of layered in other places. It's not like the books are the one place where we call out that they, this might be sort of their interest or the kind of person they are, but it's more just like another way of, kind of communicating who this person is. So we did, like it was important enough to us that we made specific technology to be able to give each of the bookshelves unique titles for the most part. So in a lot of games, like the books will just be one thing that get duplicated everywhere. So you're also like not able to give them, specific titles. But in this case, so we, because like I'm the sort of person when I walk into a room, like I'm really interested in what people have on their bookshelves as something that says something about them. So yeah, we, deliberately tried to find spaces also in each of these rooms to put books and, to have different kinds of books. So not everyone is reading novels. Some people are interested in, art books or photo books or whatever, or children's books, depending on the age of the bedroom. And that was another thing that, just in terms of like the number of books, was a way for us to also kind of play with this, kind of natural civilized divide where, again, like books like letters are this very human element, but when you get enough of them, they start to take on this kind of organic, slightly menacing quality.
Yeah, they sort of encroach because they're everywhere. They're just stacked
Yeah.
everywhere. I've actually been in a house like that. Somebody living above me in a flat I had in London. You could see that they never opened the curtains and stuff. And I think the lady up there died, or I can't remember, or moved out or something, and then her son was coming to clear it out. Oh no, it was her ex-husband, and he said, like, come upstairs, you've got to come and see him. We were like, who is this crazy guy? So we went upstairs, and it was just one of those hoarders. She'd been one of those hoarders, and it was really weird. There was like this landslide of just detritus of her life up against these win up against the windows, these floor to ceiling windows. There was a, sort of yeah like this huge It was a huge Victorian building, so really high ceilings, but she'd managed to like create a mountain that almost reached the top. And yeah, there was stuff in the bathtub. It was just everywhere. It was really weird. Yeah, it was
Yeah,
very
oh no, it's
weird.
certainly a pathology. But it is also like in its way kind of impressive and beautiful, like the way that people externalize that. Like so often, these things are just internal and maybe you can get it out like if they speak to you, but regular people don't, externalize ways that are convenient for video games.
What I was going to say was Unfinished Swan has quite a few tonal shifts from the White City to the Dark Forest, and then there's the levels I call the David Hockney bit, which is the the very white and blue. It's like his splash
The
painting.
blueprint.
And so I was wondering, does Edith Finch use these same kinds of shifts between each of the chapters? Are they very different? What can we expect in that regard?
Very different between and each of the stories is meant to feel like a different perspective, like that you're getting to see the world through a new pair of eyes. So most of them are played from first person, but not all. And what you are doing in each of the stories is completely different, and dependent on who that person is and kind of what the sort of tone of that story is. So one of our goals is to keep players always guessing about what's going to happen and always a little bit uncertain about what they're doing at any given moment. Mm-hmm. So for me as a player, you know, I think there's probably about 10 minutes in any game where I'm not quite sure how these things work and I'm still kind of getting my sea legs. Mm-hmm. And then after 10 minutes, certainly after a half hour, you know, I transition as a player from, you know, exploring this thing to trying to optimize for it and trying to do it like the best way and, you know, kind of setting my sights on something else. And we want in this game for players to always be in that kind of initial 10-minute phase. Mm-hmm. So each of the stories, you know, is changing up, like the stories themselves are changing, and then, you know, you're going between the stories and Edith frequently enough that you're always, you know, a little bit out of your comfort zone and trying to kind of foreground the element of the unknown in the game.
Excellent. I'm intrigued. I'm more and more intrigued. but how do you maintain a sense of continuity between each of the parts? Is it just by going back to the house with Edith and...
Yeah, that's I think the main way. And then we also found a number of other kind of formal elements that we could carry over. So for example, each of the bedrooms has what we call a shrine. Mm-hmm. This painting of the person who lived in that bedroom, you know, along with the dates that they lived and died. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an example of something where relatively late in development, we realized that, you know, we had all these problems. We're like, oh, people, like, it's really hard to remember the names. It's really hard to remember, like, visual elements of the players because often, or the family members, often you'll be in first person, so you don't get to see the face.
Right.
So that was kind of solving a couple of those problems. The family tree that keeps reappearing is another one of those elements. The text in the world and the use of voiceover was another thing that, you know, even though each of these stories is completely different, they are kind of regular in their difference to some extent, where, you know, you're playing as Edith for a few minutes and then you're going into the story, you're getting a new perspective, you're hearing a new voice, you know, and then within 20 minutes, like, you're back into Edith's world. So there's, you know, like a somewhat regular pace to that process. And certainly by the time you've gone through, you know, nearly, well, like many of these stories, by the time you've gone through a lot of these stories, you get into this kind of rhythm of, you know, going in and out. And hopefully, you know, we find a balance of being a little bit bewildering, but not, you know, hopelessly confusing.
Yeah. What was I going to... Oh, yeah, I really like the voice actor for Edith. She has a really lovely voice.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, just because it's a really important thing when you're not seeing a face, but you've got this voice that doesn't grate on your nerves.
Yeah, no, it took a while to find her, but Valerie Rose Lohman did a great job.
Okay, yeah.
She also has a very Edith Finch-sounding name.
Okay, yeah. Maybe that's why. She could channel the the Finch family.
Yeah, we actually, there's a scene late in the game where you hear Edith as an 11-year-old, and you know, had Valerie you know, try to perform as an 11-year-old version of herself, and it was like eerily accurate.
Oh wow!
Like, it just sounded like an 11-year-old, and I was blown away. And then she mentioned that she actually does a lot of 11-year-olds. That's the thing, like, as a voiceover actor for cartoons and other things, you know, that's a common request.
Yeah.
But, and voiceover actors are incredibly talented.
It's, yeah, they are.
You know, settling to see them shift into different characters and these kind of vocal nuances that, you know, like, I can sense, but I'm unaware of what is actually happening. But it's like, oh, yeah, somehow... just like your breathing changed and the way you clipped words and all these things. It's just like, that's an 11-year-old. That's how they talk.
Yeah, they are incredible. They're sort of chameleons, audio chameleons.
And it's a way of paying so much personality. I'm always a little disappointed that more games don't have voiceover because, you know, I think it's really hard in video games to have a sense of a human touch.
Yeah.
And is a great way of providing that.
Yeah, it's true. As I was playing Molly's Story, I felt that it had elements of The Snowman by Raymond Briggs. I don't know if you'll. Do you know? It's.
I came across that again recently, actually.
Okay, yeah, because it's a very British sort of part of childhood. A beautifully illustrated children's story, which is animated, and it's still shown on TV every Christmas, like repeatedly, so that there's no chance of you missing missing the snowman. And yeah,
Yeah, I
the
think in America we have the Rankin and Bass Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer that sort of is the corollary to that.
okay, yeah, but the piece where you were flying over the snowy landscape had that same sort of sense of wonder and kind of magic and a sort of darkness to it as well that is in the snowman. And I just wondered what your influences are beyond other games.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of children's books, certainly. So there's an author named Sean Tan,
Oh,
who
yeah.
is Australian, who I was just, looking up again. He's got a book, Tales from Suburbia, that was one of the, books that I read early on when we were developing this game. And I was just looking at his stuff, and he was talking about The Snowman again. And I was like, oh yeah, that book. I remember that. Yeah, I mean, a lot of things actually from Unfinished Swan that I was reading, like Harold and the Purple Crayon, the author of that, I think Crockett Johnson. A lot of 50s and 60s children's books that have this kind of fantastical quality that isn't too saccharine. I think, I don't know, in the 70s or 80s, things just got very bright and sweet and sort of, I don't know, like Care Bear-y. And yeah, so things like Jim Henson, I think that predate that a little bit. There's a writer, Lord Dunsany, who was writing like in the ni early 1900s and sort of prefigures a lot of modern fantasy. And he was someone that I discovered, I'd never heard anyone talk about him, but he's got a lot of really wonderful short stories that are kind of fantastical and dark and strange and that don't fit into genres. I think a lot of people making books and movies today are a little too genre specific. And, I think things before genres tend to attract my attention a little more. Other references, like Buñuel and Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie was, I mean, it's very hard. I looked at a ton of anthology movies and, anthology books. And I think, like, the idea of a short story collection is really nice, but movie, the anthologies all need to, kind of overlap with each other. And it feels like there should be some connectivity. And I don't think I've seen any good ones. They're all sort of like, at best, they're okay, or they have like really interesting, like I think Fear of the Dark was a French animated movie from a couple years ago that was pretty interesting, but doesn't really tie together so much. So yeah, I was hoping to find more anthologies to look at as references, but I had 100 Years of Solitude also is kind of the key text for this game in terms of like telling a story about a family and having a balance of fantastical moments with more human.
Sort of magical realism.
Yeah, and this as well in that kind of early magical realist vein, huge inspiration.
Excellent. So, I think this will be a final question then. What was the hardest part of the development of Edith Finch? Probably hard to pick one out, but do your
Yeah,
best.
I mean, I would say the hardest thing in the last 6 months, which is, still very present in my mind, was finding a good through line for Edith as a character and figuring out what her role should be. Because as a character, in some ways, she's the least interesting. She's making she's not really interacting with people, mm-hmm. For the most part. Like, she's coming back to this house where she grew up, but everyone is now gone mm-hmm. from. And it was difficult to figure out, you know, how much to talk about her past versus talking about her future versus talking about, you know, how she's feeling right in this moment, mm-hmm. You know, versus the stories where there was such a, you know, clear and present danger mm-hmm. of, you know, something that was incredibly important to, you know, the character in that story. And then as a player, knowing that that person was about to die, there's just like inherent drama in all of those stories. It was really difficult to go back to it,
right. You know,
where things are so much less certain. And where it's, you know, the conflict is really internal, where the story is, you know, it's much more externalized, and it's a lot easier to tell that kind of a story or to, you know, show that experience in a video game, mm-hmm. Where, you know, bringing people along on Edith's journey was very difficult, because mm-hmm. there's also a lot of other work that has to be done in terms of, you know, setting up different family members before you meet them, like reminding players after you meet them that, you know, trying to weave through all of those, you know, kind of formal or gameplay desires that we wanted Edith to be speaking to, as well as telling her story, was really difficult, and something that we couldn't really approach in a satisfactory way until everything else was in place.
Right.
So that, you know, you could be commenting on, you know, the world as it actually is. And mm-hmm. she's essentially, you know, a surrogate for the player. Like, she's commenting on the story she just experienced and what's about to happen, how she feels in this space. But it's really hard to do that when you're just looking at, you know, a bunch of gray walls early in development.
Yeah.
So that was something that kind of we had to do at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, from what I've played, it looks great, and I can't wait to play it on the 25th when it comes out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian Dallas of Giant Sparrow.